Coming to you from the AT&T podcast studio, this is Long Story Short. I'm Ted Struley, the executive director at Oklahoma Watch. We're a statewide nonprofit news organization that specializes in investigative reporting. You're listening to our weekly podcast, which lets you hear directly from our journalists as they provide deeper insight into their recently published stories. Jennifer Palmer covers education for Oklahoma Watch, and she's been investigating a state education department contract that would get more national press for State Superintendent Ryan Walters. Her latest story on that contract was a collaboration with KOKH-TV, that's Fox 25. Jennifer, you wrote about the department's proposal to hire a PR firm last fall. What's the latest?
Right. This is a story I've been following up on for several months. And the update is that the State Department of Education did award this contract to a firm in the D.C. area, Vote Strategies. And they now have a contract and have begun working for the State Department of Education and have been doing that for a couple of months.
And what kind of work are they doing?
Under the contract, they are supposed to write op-eds. They are supposed to book, leadership at the State Department of Education on national TV shows. And of course, we've seen Ryan Walters interview on many of these shows, several a week.
Now, this is public money we're spending for the PR firm. Is that right?
That's right. The contract that we have a copy of was for $30,000, and that's just for a couple of months. That's through the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, and then they have the option to extend that contract for several more years.
One thing I loved about your story is you got your hands on the emails between Vote to the news outlets, the stories they were pitching. And readers can go on our website and read those story pitches themselves. Can you give us an example of what kinds of stories they were pitching?
Right. I mean, I think this story is not so much about the dollar amount of the contract, which was, you know, fairly small in the grand scheme of the education budget, but really just the work that they're doing and the purpose of this work, which you can really see through those emails. They're pitching Walters to come on and talk about a number of issues, some barely related to education, you know, the border crisis, fentanyl, things like that. There were some pitches about PETA, the animal rights group, and his video that he made eating a hamburger, things like that. But also, pitches kind of capitalizing on this tragedy in Owosso, this student whose death now has been ruled a suicide, this non-binary student at Owosso High School. So, like you said, you can go on and read some of those for yourself to really see how they are selling him as an interviewee.
How does Walters being on national TV talking about those kinds of issues benefit Oklahoma students?
I mean, that's really the big question here. And that's what a lot of critics are saying is, that it shouldn't be public money paying for this. It feels like campaigning, a lot of these issues, a lot of things that he's talking about, Joe Biden this, Joe Biden that, it's not really a focus on Oklahoma students. And in fact, our partner Wendy Suarez in the story tried to get on the mailing list for this PR firm and could not. So, they're not working with local media, even Fox locally. They're, certainly not providing us information or interviews. I've been asking for a while now. So there really is a focus on national press here.
What was unusual about the contract?
The biggest thing, and I definitely still have some questions about this, but there was a State Department of Education employee, David Martin, who filed the incorporation paperwork. So, they the State Department of Education last fall, they put the bid, or they put the proposal out requesting bids on this contract. The day that bidding ended, this State Department of Education employee filed the incorporation paperwork with the Secretary of State. And I had never seen that before.
For the PR firm.
For the PR firm, right. For the vendor. Really unusual. You know, you would expect the vendor to do that. You would expect the State Department of Education to have some time between when the bids ended in order to vet the applications. And you would also really expect more than one vendor to bid on a contract like this. I mean, it's really not that specialized that there would only be one vendor that could do this work.
Yeah, plenty of PR firms out there, including a lot in Oklahoma that are already approved by the state to fulfill those kinds of needs.
That's right.
You mentioned that Mr. Martin filed that paperwork, and then didn't he name himself as the registered agent for the PR firm and use the Department of Ed's address?
He did, yeah. Also, really
Any
unusual.
Any explanation for that that we know of?
No, we don't really. The Department of Education's communications person, Dan Isett, says that was a mistake.
How did the Department of Ed respond to the story?
You know, I have not gotten any response out of the Department of Education. Dan Isett did talk to Wendy Suarez, and we were working together on this. You know, he says that there was an existing contract. So that this, because we asked why the work had started, you know, we have emails going back all the way to August. And the contract didn't actually begin until March.
The deadline to submit a bid wasn't even until November 9th, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Why would somebody be working on that contract months before it went into effect?
It's a big question we had. And we did ask the department that. His explanation is that there is an existing contract and that OMES approved the department continuing to work with the vendor while the RFP process was going. But as of yet, he has not produced that contract. I can't find any record that they've ever paid this firm before. I can't imagine why you would work if you're not getting paid. So I'm still trying to find out whether that contract exists. And if so, you know, what are the details on that?
There were some questions like those that remain unanswered, weren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely be continuing to follow up on this. I mean, I'm still trying to find that contract. I'm trying to find out, more about vote strategies and some other things. So we'll have some more stories coming out of this, I believe.
All right. Well, thanks, Jennifer. You can read all of Jennifer's coverage about the Department of Education's contract with the PR firm and all her other work on education in Oklahoma. You'll find it on our website, oklahomawatch.org. While you're there, you can also subscribe to her weekly newsletter, Education Watch. Reporter Paul Moneys has continued to follow the fallout from the huge run-up in natural gas costs from a winter storm that occurred in early 2021. Paul, remind us what happened during that storm.
Yeah, so this was a huge winter storm, if you remember, that hit President's Day weekend in February 2021. It hit the whole central United States, sub-zero temperatures several places, freezing rain, ice, snow, lots of demand basically on both the electrical sector for electricity generation that runs from natural gas and natural gas that heats homes. So there was kind of a double whammy in terms of what the consumers were demanding from their utilities.
Now, how are the state's utility consumers paying off those costs?
Yeah, so Oklahoma basically had some of the highest costs for natural gas during the storm in the country. Our utilities borrowed some hundreds of millions of dollars at some points to pay for that gas, to keep the lights on, to keep gas flowing to homes. And basically, lawmakers decided that to give them another option to pay back this called securitization, which is basically selling bonds to pay back the debts that the utilities had incurred for the gas costs.
Oh, has anybody challenged those high gas costs? That it just seems, I think, probably to most of us, like one of those things where opportunists sweep in like previously unknown roofers after a hailstorm, right? So how is this with consumers in Oklahoma? Is anybody fighting that?
Well, at the time, people were thinking this is really high cost. I mean, essentially the prices went from about $3 a unit before the storm to as high as $1,200 in Oklahoma and some parts of the state for the trading hub here. And so, yeah, people at the time thought, well, this is not right. And for utilities, the fuel cost is a straight pass through to customers. So essentially they can't mark up and profit from that, but it is sent on to the customers. And so at the end of the day, consumers never saw huge bills because the utilities kind of put those aside. Now we had some corporation commissioners that asked some questions. You know, we had some utilities here and there challenge the traders that sold them gas during the storm, but they really didn't do a whole lot in terms of challenging legally. We've kind of found a few lawsuits where they were successful or made some settlements.
Has there been any reduction in any of those costs to Oklahoma consumers?
Yeah, there's been a little bit here and there. There was one of our utilities, Oklahoma Natural Gas, had filed a lawsuit against one of its suppliers, NextEra Energy Marketing Services, basically over about $7 million in gas costs. Now, that was just a drop in the bucket. Oklahoma Natural Gas spent more than $1.3 billion of natural gas during that storm. That was just a tiny part of it. They actually settled out of court before it went to trial, and the terms of those settlements were confidential. Separately, there was a small kind of utility in eastern Oklahoma and western Arkansas that covers gas and electric companies there. They took on BP, the energy giant, over some of their costs during the storm. They actually took them to federal court, won a judgment that BP has not appealed, and basically some of their utility customers are getting a break on that. So we did find scattered instances here and there of that.
Now, at one point, federal authorities were investigating those gas costs from that storm. Is that still going on?
Yeah, so a lot of people are thinking there was a lot of price gouging going on. So our state AG at the time was looking into that, eventually didn't do anything with that investigation. And then secondarily, people were saying, well, the real people to investigate these natural gas prices are the feds, basically saying, look, the interstate pipelines are regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they're the ones to look at that. They did have opened some investigations following the storm. They have annual enforcement reports. That has dwindled to just one instance that we found last year that they looked at, decided there wasn't any market manipulation, and closed that investigation. So there hasn't been a whole lot that we've seen from the Fed side of things either.
What's happened in other states? Oklahoma wasn't the only state affected by this.
That's right. Yeah, we looked at several things that happened in other states. One of the most vigilant we saw was probably regulators in Minnesota. They were gripped by the same kind of storm that we were here in Oklahoma, that winter storm Uri. Their regulators actually disallowed some of the natural gas costs expended by their utilities. They basically said, look, you did not plan well enough for the storm, and you didn't really take into account that this would be a straight pass-through, and so we're buying gas at whatever the spot prices were allowing. So they disallowed about $60 million, which is still only about 10% of what the Minnesota utility spent in gas during that storm, but it was at least something. And they actually pointed out that they said, look, we were the most aggressive of all the regulators in the central United States to look at these gas costs.
Now, apart from lawsuits, could this run-up in gas prices happen? Could that happen again if there was another comparable storm?
A few things have changed since this. Utilities have said that they've done a better job of winterizing their equipment. Some of the problems with this gas supply was because it was freezing wellheads. On the coal side of things, it was coal piles that got frozen and couldn't get access to. On the wind side, there were turbines that were frozen. So lots of parts of the energy sector failed, especially on the electric utility side. But also they're looking at nothing's really changed in this whole theory of kind of the regulatory compact, which is basically allowing a monopoly utility to operate in exchange for reasonable rates for customers. Now, during storms, emergency situations, there's no incentive for utilities to hold down their fuel costs or pass straight through to customers. Nothing has changed on that front. This could very well happen again. But, you know, like that huge storm was, it was kind of, they call it once in a generation, but you never know. We've had several other types of storms that are once in a generation. We've seen other places around the country, and they're getting more frequent now. So this could happen again. And so consumers could be on the hook for another future storm like this.
Well, speaking of generations, in layman's terms, how is that spike in gas prices affecting Oklahoma consumers?
Yeah, so basically by selling these rate payer bonds, we're basically paying these costs on a kind of fixed charge on each of your utility bills, your natural gas or electricity, in the range of about $8 to $15 per month extra, a surcharge on your bill, for the next 25 to 28 years in some cases. So it's a whole generation of costs tied to that meter in that house that had coverage and storm access during that time. So it's I would kind of call it like it's basically paying for your fuel costs from your grandfather's car back in the fuel crisis of the 70s. You know, you're going to pay for that for years as a customer. Whoever comes to your house after you, if you sell it, will pay that because that meter was tied at that time. So it's kind of tied to that house and that location, but it's a fixed charge. That was the only way they could figure out how to make it cost the utilities to take it off their balance sheets and have consumers not have huge bill shocks right away for their paying hundreds and thousands of dollars for a bill per month.
All right. Well, thanks, Paul. You can read all of Paul's coverage of state government and his other work on our website, oklahomawatch.org. Keaton Ross covers democracy and criminal justice for Oklahoma Watch. In his latest story, he wrote about two legislative proposals that would make it more difficult to get a state question on the ballot. Keaton, what do House Bill 1105 and House Joint Resolution 1054 propose?
The first bill, House Bill 1105, has several provisions. It would require circulators to get a background check. So that's whoever's at, you know, Walmart or whatever, trying to get you to sign a petition would have to get an OSBI background check and pay for that. Would require petitioners to pay a $1,000 filing fee. And it would also increase the challenge period from 10 to 90 days. The second bill, House Joint Resolution 1054, would require a percentage of signatures to be collected in all 77 counties.
What prompted those bills?
There were several factors. Of course, we've had a lot of high-profile state questions over the past decade or so. Of course, the state question 780 and 781 dealing with criminal justice reform, the medical marijuana bill that passed in 2018, as well as Medicaid expansion. So there has been some pushback to some of those bills that were passed by voters in the legislature that has led to some of this pushback, wanting to tighten up the state question process. There's somewhat of a prevailing opinion among a lot of Republicans in the legislature that these state questions are funded by a lot of out-of-state money and that they are sort of looking for smaller states to test out a question or get something on the ballot. So that's those previous efforts that some legislators don't like, as well as that sort of school of thought that there's too much outside money in these state question races.
Now, we've seen similar bills proposed over the last several years, right?
That's right. It particularly ramped up after the Medicaid expansion vote in 2020. And we've seen that continue for a few years. Of course, another note in that, of course, is the Dobbs decision in the Supreme Court leaving abortion access up to the states. There have been some Republican states looking to clamp down, change the state question process in response to that, not wanting to get an abortion question on the ballot. So there's that at play as well in sort of this conversation.
So who's opposing these measures and what's their view?
So it's mostly Democrats. There was on one of the bills, House Bill 1105, there was just one Republican to vote against it. But a lot of them spoke against the measure when it was put up to a vote in the legislature, saying that it would effectively silence the voice of the people. There were a handful that had free speech concerns as far as, you know, if someone I mentioned the background check provision. someone would be required to get a background check, but state law couldn't prevent them from collecting signatures if something came up on that background check. So there's a question of, well, why is this necessary? Or is the state going to release this information and put someone on blast if they have a criminal record, essentially, was the argument. Mostly in the legislature, Democrats have argued against it. There have also been several groups that are proponents of direct democracy and that sort of thing that have also come out against these measures.
But nonetheless, it's not an issue that falls neatly right along party lines, is it?
That's right. I mentioned there was one Republican, Daniel Pay from Lawton, that voted against House Bill 1105 when it came up for a vote. I also, when I was reporting this story, talked with Walt Hill, who is a former Republican House back when the Republicans had a minority in the legislature, which is a little hard to believe at this point, but talked with him, and he actually ran an initiative petition when he was in office to cap the how long the legislature can stay in session, putting their sine die date at the end of May. So he was really opposed to some of these bills when I talked to him, saying essentially it's okay if you don't like something that a state question proposed and passed and ended up in law, but you shouldn't change the process entirely because of that.
Did anybody file bills to make the initiative petition process easier or more accessible?
There were a few bills authored by Democrats that would, I believe one was from Representative Mickey Dolenz, a Democrat from Oklahoma City, that would increase the signature collection time frame from 90 to 180 days. That sort of, you talk to a lot of folks who argue that Oklahoma's process is quite difficult. The 90-day signature collection time frame is often brought up as one of the main hurdles, just not a ton of time to go out and get, in some cases, over 100,000 signatures. So that was one bill. I believe there were maybe one or two others along a similar frame of making the signature process easier, but they ultimately didn't get a hearing before the necessary deadline.
Now, 1105 and 1054, those bills that would restrict ballot access, or as some call it, direct democracy, right? Voters' opportunity to propose their own laws and go around the legislature if legislators aren't putting up bills that they want to see. What's the status on those at the moment?
House Bill 1105, the proposal that would require background checks and increase the challenge period, that bill has passed the House. It's on to the Senate, where it's authored by Julie Daniels from Bartlesville. The House Joint Resolution 1054, which, as it was written, would go to a vote of the people if it was passed, but it did not get out of the House before the March 14th deadline for it to pass over. So that proposal is effectively dead this year.
All right. Now, have there been any initiative petitions circulated that we might see on a ballot anytime soon?
There is. There is State Question 832 that proposes raising the minimum wage incrementally to $15 an hour by 2029 and then tying future increases to U.S. Department of Labor data. That is nearing the signature collection period. Organizers believe they should start collecting signatures sometime in the next couple of weeks. And there's a possibility that could end up on the November ballot, but there's still signature verification process and some other hurdles that has to clear first.
All right. Well, thanks, Keaton. You can read all of Keaton's work on democracy and criminal justice at our website, oklahomawatch.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for Keaton's weekly newsletter, Democracy Watch. You've been listening to Long Story Short, a weekly podcast that helps you get deeper into the investigative stories reported by Oklahoma Watch. which you can find on the web at oklahomawatch.org. This episode was recorded at the AT&T Podcast Studio. For Oklahoma Watch, I'm Ted Strooley. Thanks for listening.